curious about it.
Alright, I just turned the radio on. I was shopping, so... But I am now home, and gotta get ready for work tomorrow. So thanks, Rich. Alright, back to you, Roy, WA2CDL. Catch you next time.
Okay, very good, Andy. Sleep well, don't work too hard, and we'll talk again. We'll give it one more time, try with Craig, OGB. Are you still out there, and did you come up with any question? Because you kind of put your name down, but didn't really indicate a question. Yes, Rich. Yeah, that's kind of reasonable. The problem is if you're immunocompromised, I don't know what the additional shot will help. I guess it'll help a bit. Better than nothing, as the old saying goes.
I saw an interview on 60 Minutes where this doctor was saying that, you know, they're worried about the initial shots wearing off by now, so that's why they're recommending a fourth booster.
Well, I don't know. They always kind of have problems with deciding when the last booster is fading in power because it requires studies. Usually, for some odd reason, it's the Israelis who publish these studies earlier than anyone else. So it certainly wouldn't surprise me. Some of the pharmaceutical companies are working on modification of the vaccine to cover specifically Omicron mutations as well. So that's going to be a factor in addition. They're going to have to come to kind of some kind of conclusion of, you know, when the Omicron effective vaccine boosters will be approved and, you know, if they'll be approved within a relatively narrow time, it might pay to kind of delay the booster and benefit from the additional Omicron immunity. So, you know, all those things have to get lined up, I guess.
So are you saying that the boosters available right now don't include the Omicron variant, huh?
No, the boosters are all basically the original vaccine. In the case of Moderna, they cut the dosage in half, but they haven't been modified because they would have to go through the same phase 1, 2, 3 approval method, and that takes some time. So I'm not quite sure whether they'd be able to manufacture and get the approval in time for recommended additional booster shot for people at high risk.
I was Pfizer. I forget the other one. Moderna. They're advocating fourth and fifth booster shot. A fourth and fifth for those that got the non-Pfizer originally.
Well, I'm not quite sure what the logic is. With the people, unfortunately, Johnson & Johnson vaccine had a whole bunch of problems. They had a problem with production. One of the secondary manufacturers fouled up the system, and they had to throw out a large amount of produced vaccines. And then they pretty much decided that it probably should have been a two-shot situation for Johnson & Johnson, just like Moderna and Pfizer. And so there was one point where people were suggesting that, you know, they should get either a second shot of Johnson & Johnson or they should get a shot of Moderna or Pfizer. So it's a bit complicated, especially when Johnson & Johnson is concerned. I don't think, I think a very relatively small percentage of Americans ended up getting the Johnson & Johnson because of all the snafus of manufacturing and production.
As of tonight, 68% of the population is unvaccinated. That's 68%.
Yeah, well, but that's also that's a shifting definition, because if you took the early definition of people who got two shots of Moderna or Pfizer, I think you'd get a higher percentage. What they're doing now is they're factoring in the boosters as well. So if you had the first two shots but you didn't get the booster, in the old days they would say X percentage weren't vaccinated, Y percentage haven't gotten the booster yet. They've kind of merged the two together. So I think when they're talking about unvaccinated, and usually they qualify it with not fully vaccinated, includes the people who never got the boosters.
KD2FIU input.
Yes, George.
Roy, can we get a clarification on Rich's Rich's input there on 68%? Let's put it into a geographical realm here. Is it 68% of New York City, New York State, the United States, the world, regions, anything? 68% have not been vaccinated? Far from what I am perceiving with the data that's coming my way for where I live, my city, my region, my state, my country, and my hemisphere. This is very 68% of where, Rich?
George, 68% of the United States.
And it's usually the adult population.
So the adult population is the majority in the United States of not being vaccinated. How about New York State? How about New York City? How about Long Island? Do we have any figures on that?
George, AC2GS, by the way. George, I think what happens is, as you get up north, for a sundry number of reasons, the vaccination percentages get higher and higher. It's not that 68 aren't vaccinated. I don't think. I'll ask Rich. It's 68% of adults in the United States are vaccinated. It depends, again, whether they're going to say it's partially vaccinated or fully vaccinated with a booster or what have you. But this is a broad average across the entire United States. And when you start to piece apart different states, New York is one of those that have a higher incidence of vaccination and booster than, say, Florida and such.
Thank you, Roy, and that I totally believe. Did we say that it was 68% unvaccinated? I want to clarify what Rich said. Positive vaccination or negative with the vaccination?
I reckon that 68% are unvaccinated. 68% are unvaccinated.
Okay, I would tend to believe that that definition included the boosters, personally.
You may be right. It may be 68% vaccinated, 68% vaccinated, but it's pretty close to 50 anyway, so that's scary.
Well, this is the never-ending problem with this situation, because some people are not kind of taking it very seriously and haven't for the most part. You get these large pools of completely ready to be fully infected and to die. You know, the death rate and other such things, you know, is finally going down, but for a while it was very scary again. The problem is there's a large reservoir of unimmunized, not yet infected people waiting to give this virus an opportunity to mutate into another damn Greek letter in the Greek alphabet. And, you know, even if we cover ourselves in the United States, if we don't kind of share the wealth with the third world and Africa and South America, are not immunized, they're going to be a reservoir for mutations, and they'll bounce right back to the United States. That's been kind of proven repeatedly. Omicron appears to have come out of South Africa, although who knows? And so, you know, what happens in South Africa affects us here in Brooklyn.
Medicare, if you can copy me, Roy. Can you copy me enough for me to read what Medicare just released?
Yeah, sure. You're only about 30-40% noise, so I can hear you.
Says people with Medicare coverage are one of the most fully vaccinated groups of people in the United States. And then in big bold letters it says, now is the time to take the next step towards added protection through booster shots. Don't wait. By getting vaccinated, including a booster shot, you are playing an important role in our response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Vaccines help you and those around you to stay safe and healthy. Everyone with Medicare can get a booster shot for the same COVID-19 vaccine that you originally got or choose a different one. The date you're eligible for booster shot might vary depending on whether you originally received Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson. To find the booster now at vaccines.gov. So if you're interested, if you think you're eligible, go to vaccines.gov, and that'll point you to whether you got your first, or second, or third, or fourth shot.
KD2FIU for clarification, please.
Yes, certainly, George. I just want to point out that that's sort of old news, Rich. Basically, they approved the booster shots for everyone, and if you have any kind of coverage whatsoever, they pay for it. So, you know, I mean, that's how I got a booster shot, and how many of us got booster shots. So the initial booster shot was another semi-freebie, if you will. But, George, you wanted to make a comment or clarification?
Yes, I heard Rich. I heard Rich coming in. But is he talking about the booster shot that was recommended at the end of last summer into early fall? Or is he talking about what they've recommended for a fourth for some of the population?
What happened to the TechNet?
Well, if you got a technical question, you could ask the technical question. We just went on a kind of a side trip here somewhere. But we'll get back to it. Yeah, that would be an interesting point, Rich. I'm not quite sure how old that information is. There's a big difference between a booster shot and a fourth shot of a series of shots. So probably it needs to be better defined.
Vaccines are technical issues.
George says if you want more information, you can go to Medicare.gov or CDC.gov/coronavirus. And this just came in the mail this week. So it sounds like it's outdated, and it doesn't specifically say a fourth booster shot, but if you want information on Medicare.gov or CDC.gov/coronavirus, I heard on the news tonight that CDC has just recommended a fourth booster shot for those who are immune compromised.
Okay. You know, that's a much smaller population, and, you know, I sort of understand the idea, but that doesn't really translate to them, you know, overnight saying it's time for everyone to get another booster shot. And so, again, there are other kind of complications in that if they feel that they can get approval of an Omicron type of vaccine booster in the near future, they'll probably delay any public relations call for people getting yet another booster. Because every iteration of asking people to get boosters, you're going to kind of develop a bigger and bigger group of people saying, screw you. So they have to factor that in as well. I mean, it might come to the point where this is all rather endemic, like influenza is, and every year you get yourself a flu shot if you're take proper care of yourself. Who knows? I don't know. It really shouldn't be a reason to argue politics or economics or what have you, or paranoid delusions. You know, keep it to the literature. You know, science is good. You know, we talk science all the time here, and science is a very good thing.
Science is big news, didn't you know that?
You know, it kind of defeats the purpose of anything you say if you say it with a raspy voice and you don't ID yourself. You know, it's kind of like walking around with a placard that says, don't listen to me. I'm not quite right, but yeah, that's just a recommendation for you to think about.
But you answered back. That means you heard me.
Roy, can I say something? And it's in a very positive direction.
Certainly, George.
The sun has come up in the morning. And people are arguing about it. Let's talk about how beautiful it is.
And I agree. Well, the problem is that some people don't understand. You could use as raspy voice as you want. I have a voice analyzer in here with the software that cost me $7,500. You think you're going to hide? You don't. Try again. And I assume you have a database of...
Okay, AC2GS, Net Control, KD2FIU. I hope you understood what I said, because I mean that to really have people understand how beautiful things are, not how bad things are.
AC2GS. I understand and I agree with you, George. The world is a wonderful place. Being alive is a wonderful, delightful thing. Being alive in this age, even though there's a couple little bumps in the road, we're living in a golden age of technology. There's so much being discovered. And there's so much that we could talk about. That shouldn't really produce any animosity or anger or upset or what have you. And I would love to actually go back to that. Unfortunately, Jeff, who was on EchoLink, appears to have left us. He may come back later. He had a question and a comment, but unfortunately he had to leave. So if there's anyone out there who has a different subject, preferably science, preferably amateur radio, please give me your first name and your call sign.
KD2BKA with a quick question.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. When you guys were speaking earlier about the using the guttering system as a form of antenna, one of the comments was that you wouldn't ground your antenna because you could lose, I guess, lose some resonance, I believe is what the gentleman had mentioned. And I was just curious because I have just a Ringo Cushcraft 270, I think it's an AR-70, and it's my understanding that the outer shell of the coax itself, although it, you know, it's just terminating on an SO-239 or whatever it is up top, but the bracket that it mounts to gets a ground down to, I ran into a ground rod, and I'm just wondering, am I actually losing signal by doing that? Should I remove the ground, or is it something that you would recommend keeping?
No, I would recommend keeping that. The shield is usually at some ground potential. What we were talking about was that the actual element that was radiating and receiving shouldn't be grounded, shorted together. If both the mount is grounded and the radiating antenna is grounded, there's no difference in voltage potential, so there's no RF getting into your receiver, so you're not receiving anything. So you have to have at least one part of your antenna that is not at ground potential.
An SWR check would resolve that, WB2AV.
Well, that's true. There's a lot of things, but I was just talking generally that you wouldn't want a short. You know, some people unfortunately don't have an SWR meter. Some radios don't come with them. But you're quite right, Ed.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's very helpful. This is KB2BKA. I'll let you get back to it. I appreciate the info.
Can I say something, Roy?
Certainly.
As I see it, there are two aspects to antennas. One is the basics, which an SWR meter will tell you. If you have a good SWR, you're clean. The second one is a radiation pattern, which is much more subtle, much more sophisticated, and virtually impossible, if not completely impossible, to measure. And especially on HF, where you get what you get and don't waste time worrying about it.
I agree with you entirely, Ed. Let me see if I have it. Okay. I agree with you entirely. I mean, often I'll tell people that VizWars are very nice. Having a one-to-one is very nice, except that you got to keep in mind that a dummy load, which I would not use on any contest or for any communications for distance, will give you a one-to-one VizWa. So life is more than a one-to-one VizWa. I mean, with the exception is if you're really local and your dummy load is not theoretical and so it leaks. I've had conversations with nearby hams as a lark of connecting my dummy load as my antenna. But, yeah, efficiency is important. The amount of RF generated and transmitted, and the pattern. If the pattern is all pointed up and you have a near vertical incident sky wave and you would like to operate DX, lots of luck with that. So yeah, there's a lot of complications to antennas that VizWas do not answer. So I agree with you entirely.
Can I just comment about the dummy load first?
Certainly.
A dummy load, as you well know, converts RF energy into heat. Dummy loads get hot. You know, if you're putting it to 100 watts into a dummy load, it will get really hot. If you're only putting 2 watts into a dummy load, depending on the size, maybe not so much. But that goes to an antenna. If you can physically reach an antenna, if you transmit into an antenna for a while with a decent amount of power, then I suggest you stop transmitting so it's not the RF burns. If it's hot, you may have a point. If it's cold to the touch, you're not dissipating energy as heat like a dummy load does.
Again, I agree with you entirely, but the takeoff angle does have an effect upon the effectiveness of an antenna. If you're looking for local communications, then a near vertical incident sky wave is what you would be looking for. If you're looking to skip off of the ionosphere, you probably want something with a much more horizontal takeoff angle. And you won't be able to perceive that by the temperature of the antenna because it'll be transferring the electrical energy into RF energy just as well as an antenna with a different radiation pattern.
100%, but there are some things you're not saying. I have worked on stuff where you want to send all of the energy straight up, say, into space. If you have any idea how difficult that is to focus all the energy straight up, let me just say, you have no idea how difficult that is. Now, if you go to heaven and earth to put together an array of multi-element yogis all faced together pointing straight up, yeah, but no one in his right mind is going to do that to work yet. What I'm saying is, what I find is people obsess over minor deviations. For classic one, I've said a million times, including on this net, is that if you put up a dipole, and it's running through the trees, it's running next to the rain gutters, which are aluminum, I assume, you're not going to get a classic pattern. So maybe, instead of getting a perfect signal coming in from antenna, you get a slightly reduced signal from antenna, but you get a really good one from Illinois. In other words, you're just changing the pattern. And that's a much more realistic thing, is that you're not achieving the pattern you want exactly, rather than getting one that's completely out to lunch, because that probably takes a lot of work to do that too.
Okay, I agree with you. The only problem I have sometimes is there is the occasional guy who would like to have long distance conversations. They have a dipole, and because of limitations of their property, they have it something like an eighth of a wavelength off the ground. At an eighth of a wavelength off the ground, you're going to get more of a near vertical sky wave, incident sky wave, than you are the pattern that's theoretical. And I agree with you. Theoretical is labeled theoretical because it doesn't happen in reality. It is the perfect dreamed of pattern. But since you do not put dipoles up into outer space where nothing else affects them, you are not going to have a theoretical pattern. You are going to have a pattern distorted because of all the realities of your life and your topology and the architecture and the materials and such. But, you know, you suffer through it as best you can. So, you know, I'm pretty much in agreement with you, Ed.
KD2FIU.
You a one-word answer to the question you posed a minute ago. That word is Croatia.
KD2FIU.
Okay, George recognized. I just want to quite know what you mean by Croatia.
One day, I was having a little trouble with the radio. Yeah, it was right after field day. And I had a radio at field day, and it was giving us a little bit of trouble. It was a beautiful day, so I set up a picnic table in the backyard, and I found out what the problem is, and I got an idea. I have this 40-meter dipole I made just as a receiving antenna. And I took my antenna tuner, put it on the picnic table. Actually, it was a folding card table, that's right. I set up this antenna just high enough that it wouldn't catch me in the neck to choke me. It was a 40-meter dipole on 20 meters. The ring was working fine. I'm just tuning around. I hear a guy in Croatia, you know, rattling through stations. I gave him a call and he came back. That antenna was 7 feet off the ground.
Okay, and there was a guy, I forget his name, but Dick would mention it repeatedly, a guy who basically had an antenna that most people looking at wouldn't believe it would do anything. It was basically sitting on the ground somehow, and he was getting distant conversations. So a lot of times stuff that theoretically doesn't make any sense to many of us works. And so, you know, you go with what works, as the old adage goes.
And as long as you're radiating energy, if you're not radiating straight up into space, there will be reflections off of stuff around you, and it is an absolute crapshoot that you have zero control over.
Well, I don't know, 0%. You might be able to better the odds by 2 or 3% if you're clever, but yeah. Sometimes, you know, I mean, you kind of, in the old days, especially when G5RV was very, very popular, it's kind of faded away a bit. It's such a weird, esoteric, mixed mode thing that it's very sensitive to how you implement it and where you put it and where you put it next to. So that it's a crapshoot. People I know who've had G5RVs love them and wouldn't live without them. And I know other people who threw them out in the garbage the next day. So, yeah, you need a lot of luck with most things, and this certainly goes with amateur radio.
WHCDL, I'm listening, and I got a question for Ed.
KD2FIU, wanted to finish?
Yeah, George, go first, and then Andy.
You remember Faraday, and the way he put it was, the magnetic field will introduce an electron flow into a conductor, and the electron flow introduced into a conductor will introduce a magnetic field that is traveling. Oh, the antenna. That's the conductor. The antenna is the conductor. There are so many ways to do it over the field of Earth around you, around the surrounding objects around you, the height above ground, the vertical, the angular polarization and everything. So that conductor, being the antenna, is the whole big concept that we love to talk about. Back to you, Roy, KD2FIU.
Okay, very good. And I'll remind people, just because it annoys the heck out of me, that the way that magnetic fields induce electric fields and electric fields induce magnetic fields appears to be in quadrature, which means that they're out of phase with each other. But RF that's in the far field is in phase. So somewhere between your antenna and the far field, the phase relationships appear to change. And I have yet to find a good explanation, and I have looked through a lot of books and a lot of web pages. But I'll just kind of throw that out and pass it on to Andy. Wanted to ask Ed a question.
Yes, I do. Good evening. Just clarify for me, Ed. I read somewhere, and I don't remember when or where. It's a while back. In dealing with glide slope antennas located at airports, the technical article mentioned that the major lobe of a glide slope antenna is more or less at a high angle of radiation, and it's the minor lobes below that that are used for the airplane's approach, and the antenna is specifically designed to have that major lobe pointing not out to the horizon, which would be a low angle of radiation, but a much higher one, where they use the minor lobes for glide slope operation. I said the minor lobes. Is that true, Ed, as far as you know?
First of all, do I have Net Control's approval to proceed?
Certainly, Ed.
I cannot say out and out that is wrong, but my gut feeling is that it has to be wrong. What you want to do for a glide slope antenna, if you're trying to guide an airplane into a landing using the instrument landing system, you want to bring that plane down a 3-degree glide slope. And the way they do it is they have two signals. One of them a little above 3 degrees, and one of them a little below 3 degrees, and they're very narrow. They take fairly large antennas to get the beam to be, you know, a very small beam, because the guy also has to be coming reasonably close to the center line, so you want it fairly focused, and you don't want to spray RF energy all over the place, which is what you're describing. They're saying you're using the main lobe going straight up. You're throwing that energy away and just using side lobes, throwing energy out at odd angles. Kind of like, as an example of side lobes, you take a flashlight. There's a bright beam in the center, and you see little bits of light around it. Those are the side lobes. It's imperfections in the parabolic reflector. So why would you want to throw away the great majority and just use second order effects? So I find that virtually impossible to believe. If anything, it's that the side lobes go straight up with, like, you know, 10% or less power. But the idea being, you want to send a relatively narrow beam just above the glide slope, a relatively narrow beam just below the glide slope, and they each have audio modulations. And the idea being, you want to decode both of the signals and do a comparison check, so that the two amplitudes of the modulations are equal. Have I answered your question, Andy?
Yeah, you gave me some more insight. So does that require to have 3 degrees on the plus side? And I'm just using that as a nomenclature, plus or minus. 3 degrees going up, 3 degrees going down, does that require two separate antennas to do that, or is that done with just one antenna?
I am no expert, but I can't see how you wouldn't need two separate antennas. By the way, this is for commercial aviation. I know a lot more about landing planes on aircraft carriers where the standard is 4 degrees, but they use a tracking antenna, which I found very entertaining, a little fun fact. The kind of radar used to guide planes onto the deck of an aircraft carrier has a tremendous amount in common with the kind of radar and antenna that you try to poke to aim anti-aircraft fire. I find that hysterical, but off topic. Andy?
Okay, very good. I wasn't thinking about the aircraft carrier landings with a different degree angle that you're talking about. I read this in a magazine going back to the 1940s. I don't know what frequency they were referring to. I'm not sure if it was mentioned, as compared to the frequencies that they use now for glide slope. It might be the same, or it might have changed. I know there's a great interest in the microwave cell phone region that everyone's been talking about. So I'm assuming that glide slope frequencies have changed since the 40s. I'm just assuming that because I have not done any research on it. But, okay. Because I would think that for glide slope, you're not transmitting for distance. You know, your transmit range is much shorter. And at the same time, you don't want to waste all the energy from the main lobes just going out into free space at the wrong angle. But I remember seeing this article where it actually showed the major lobe pointing not straight up, but at a pretty high angle. And they were showing the multiple minor lobes actually being used for glide slope. But again, we're talking about in the 1940s now, so it's old technology.
They did a lot of crazy things in the 1940s, many of which have held through to this day. Not all. Remember, sometimes you have to do crazy things for lack of this magical mystery piece that doesn't exist. So you make do with what you can. Then someday somebody invents this magical mystery piece and you throw away the old design and you redesign using it to do what you really wanted to do all along but couldn't do until now. That happens all the time.
Okay, I understand that. There's an article that I'm going to dig up, which I will read when I find it. I'll have a little mini Andy's Corner. I think you'd find it rather fascinating, which I just reminded myself about. I'm going to have to dig up the magazine on it and read that. But I won't give it away just yet. It'll be a surprise because it's a quite a clever design. Nothing to do with glide slope, by the way. It just reminded me. All right, thanks for that. Incidentally, as a footnote, just one more thing. Just getting away from glide slope, you gave me a little insight. Thanks with the angles being plus and minus and the theory behind it, basically. But when you're measuring SWR, and Ed, you probably have run into this because I have. Sometimes SWR going into an antenna could be deceiving, and that is determined basically by a number of factors. One of them, in my opinion, is how much power are you using to measure the SWR, because if your feed line, coax cable or whatever feed line you're using, has a high attenuation, don't forget that the wave has to make two trips. It has to make the trip towards the antenna and then the wave reflected back from the antenna. And if you're transmitting with a very low power level, whatever you're using, and if you have a high attenuation on that line, for whatever reason, by the time that signal gets back to wherever you're measuring it from, let's say your shack, it could show that you have a very low reflected power and compared to what you're transmitting. I mean, there is a certain ratio, and that's what it is, BSWR. But it could be deceiving because of that attenuation. I'm sure you've run into that before. So I just thought I'd mention that, Ed. Back to you, Roy. That's it. I'm going to go back to listening because I'm doing other things as well. WHCDL.
DDH with a comment.
Hold on,
Ed.
You just said okay.
You double with VDH. VDH, stand by. What'd you say, Ed?
I just want to finish up. You got 30 seconds?
You got as many seconds as you want, Ed. John, by the way, recognize we'll get to you second.
The answer to your question is yes. I have definitely seen, if you have a long run of coax, the attenuation of the coax will give you a misleading improvement in the SWR. Let's say you have an antenna with an SWR of 3-1, and you feed it with a long coax. Yeah, there will be enough coax, you can get it down to 1.5-1. On the other hand, there is a bright side to this. The reason we only care about SWR on transmit, not so much on receive, is we've all seen a really lousy SWR antenna will receive halfway decently. A really lousy high SWR antenna will transmit halfway decently, but it's the transmitter that objects violently. So if you cheat by wasting some energy in the coax, it's possible you'll have a happy transmitter and you'll get enough out of the antenna that you will work that station.
I agree, but to a point, yes, I agree that. Go ahead, whoever, back to you, if you want to continue.
People will reach the antenna.
Okay, copy that, I agree. Roy?
AC2GS, very good. Yeah, The problem is that the output, the power output circuits don't want to have watts, a lot of watts of electricity going into them. They want to go out of them. So they'll fold over and give you problems. And if you attenuate it enough and you don't trigger the fold over, then you get partial signals. So yeah, that's an interesting little extra on that. John, you wanted to say something.
I think was already said. The high loss on the cable can make a horrible SWR look good, and that's why sometimes good to use a return loss as a measurement. Also, the glide slope frequencies. I just Googled that 330 to 334 megahertz.
Okay, very good, and. The reason for those people who don't know the difference between different pieces of equipment is that the standing wave ratio of many meters is basically they look at the forward and reflected power, they figure out the ratio and they calculate the standing wave ratio based on it. If you use something like a vector network analyzer that introduces its own signal, it uses a different method, so attenuation losses would not factor into the VISWA calculation. So that's always a good idea to understand the limitations of the equipment you're using, both for radio in general and for test equipment.
Okay, well, thanks for getting that, too. All right, I'm going to sign to be continued, and I will come. I'll be back. Not tonight, though, but I will be back. WHCDL. Thanks, guys. Go ahead, Lloyd.
Okay, very good. You will return, in the words of Arnold Schwarzenegger. And we look forward to that. Thanks for participating tonight, Andy, and Ed, and John, and everyone. Not that we're kind of closing it for the night, but I might as well take an opportunity to thank the people that make the Technical Net an interesting place. If anyone has any other comments and or new topics of discussion, please let me know by hitting the push to talk and giving me your first name and your call sign. Gosh, don't tell me you're all talked out tonight. It's only 9:48. There's got to be someone somewhere with either a question or an observation or a comment. Yes, Rich.
Just wondered if Andy is still listening. How do you know whether you're getting a spurious SWR reading or you're getting a correct one? Go ahead.
Should I try that?
Yeah, sure, Ed.
Let me just say, let's call it common sense. I mean, these things don't just sneak up and bite you. For example, a long coax will give you an improved SWR. But like I said before, if you can get the SWR down to the point where the transmitter is happy, you will get some, admittedly reduced, but you will get some performance. So in a way, it's a way of cheating and using a really lousy antenna to get poor performance as opposed to the transmitter shutting down completely. Another thing is the length of a coax, in theory, should not change the SWR other than attenuation. But in the real world, you might find different lengths of coax will give you different SWRs, because what happens is any antenna load has an impedance. There's a resistive part, and there's a reactive, i.e. capacitive or inductive part. And what happens is, as you travel down the coax, basically, I'm not sure if anybody's going to follow this, you're going around the Smith chart, and it's almost like, the impedances, the resistances, the capacitances are all changing. So you can get some fluky stuff there, but it's usually a minor effect. Because like I said, this in theory does cancel out, but there are some effects that can do it. So it's not totally out of the question. We're changing things around, changing your test. Can give you a different SWR with the same antenna, but it's really kind of hard to predict, and it's more like common sense. If you're doing anything really, really weird, maybe it's that. If you're just doing meat and potatoes, you're hooking a coax up to the transmitter, up to the antenna, it really shouldn't be of an issue.
KD2FYU.
Yes, George?
Okay, for those who are learning to build antennas, all right, the important thing here to remember is that you can tune any conductor to be where you want it to be on the frequency that you want to transmit and receive. A longer conductor length will give you a better tune than a shorter conductor length, not all the time. For example, if you want to tune on 40 meters, 75, 80 meters with a 10 or 20 meter length antenna, you can do it with the right resistive tune and reflective tune capacitive, resistive capacitive system. It will tune. But if you're going to go in reverse and say that I want to take an 80 meter long antenna, 40 meter long antenna, and tune it on 10 meters with the right resistive load, and get the right X load on it, you're going to have a better antenna. So it's not that longer antennas are better. What I'm saying is that shorter antennas tune less well on lower frequencies of longer bandwidth, and longer antennas tune much better on higher frequencies with shorter bandwidth. KD2FYU.
AC2GS. Well, George, we sort of covered that a couple of months ago. I think actually it might have been a question that Rich asked. We discussed a couple things. One of them in that a very long, an antenna that is electronically too long is inductive. And so the way to electronically shorten it is to introduce a capacitance to it. And capacitance has very little loss in such a circuit. Whereas if you have a antenna that's electronically too short, you have to, it has a capacitance, reactive capacitance that you want to cancel out, and that would require an inductor. Inductors introduce a significant more energy loss, so they're not as efficient as capacitors. But there are other factors as well. But I agree with you in concept to what that you said. You can basically resonate anything if you have enough capacitance and inductance. The problem is going to be a reflection and attenuation loss and other such. And just want to touch on one thing. Let me drop for a sec. I just want to touch on, again, another old story that I've repeated probably too many times, that I had a situation where an older antenna tuner of mine could not tune my 10-meter antenna. And when I put an extra 3-foot jumper on it, it rotated the impedance just enough so that the tuning circuit of the antenna tuner could then tune it to 50 ohms nominal impedance. So if your antenna is a perfect 50 ohms, the length of the transmission line will not affect the impedance, but if it is at a non-50 ohm termination, effectively, it will rotate the impedance down the transmission line. So by lengthening it, you can shift the impedance, the phase angle and the other values, and possibly bring it into the tuning range of your antenna tuner.
Hey, KD2FIU?
Well, I was just bumpering over.
I'm sorry, George. Ed, I doubled with you.
I said what you said, Roy, is a magnificent example of the concept I was trying to explain a minute ago and having trouble with.
KD2FIU.
George recognized that. Thank you, Ed. I'll take that as a compliment. I found it fascinating when I discovered it myself, and then I looked it up and read about it, and it gave me a better appreciation for the concept. So I'm glad that you liked it.
KG2RY.
Okay, David, George wanted to talk first, so first George, then David.
Okay, we were dealing with the feed line, not the device itself being the device as the antenna. And I was talking about the antenna, the actual conductor in the air. Going back to what you said about the feed line, it being coax, different from balanced line, I had one situation where I required a 5/16 length of the feed line to actually bring the impedance and the inductance to a satisfactory level to the transceiver. How I came across it with some old manuals in an ARRL book from 1998. I could not believe that it precisely worked. I was adjusting the feed line to make the antenna work to what I want, but I knew the antenna was not what I wanted 100%. KD2FIU, thank you, Roy, and turn it over. Thanks.
Okay, very good. Yeah, transmission line impedance transformation is a really interesting subject in general. Recently, I was talking to someone about phasing two Yagis together. The way that you do it is to use 75-ohm coax. I think it's, I forgot if it's a half a length or a quarter of a wavelength. And the way that the impedances are transformed, it works beautifully to get a phase array. So transmission line impedance matching is a thing. There's a lot of literature on the material. David, you wanted to say something.
Good evening, Roy. First thing I want to say is I hope you're having a great evening. Second thing I want to say is that I had similar experiences like you with different lengths and different jumper cables and different interconnect. Go figure. That with the antenna tuner, different devices like antenna switches and such. And the other question I had, the third part is, what do you have to say about fan dipoles regarding this issue?
I'm not quite sure what exactly you're alluding to. It was a fan dipole that was my 10-meter element that I couldn't tune with that jumper. So it works the same way as any other antenna, that there are some antennas that simply their impedance value for the frequency that you want to tune to is outside the range of antenna tuner that you own. And there's no universal antenna tuner that can tune everything in a Smith chart. And Dick, K2RIW, used to lament the fact that the manufacturers will not publish a Smith chart showing the ranges of impedance that are able to be corrected from their manufactured antenna tuners. So it actually that example that I gave is based on the 10 meter element of a fan dipole.
QSL. I also have a fan dipole, and I tried to tune on 10 meters, 28.380. I wasn't getting the best result.